was to be signed 2 months later. Russia would attempt to halt this process on the grounds that nothing new can happen within its spiritual sphere of influence, the Russian world, as Putin began to say. His attempt to apply a Russian politics of eternity beyond Russia's borders had unintended consequences. Ukrainians responded by creating new kinds of politics. Nations are new things that refer to old things. It matters how they do so. It is possible, as Russian leaders have done, to issue ritual incantations designed to reinforce the status quo at home and justify empire abroad. To say that Rus is Russia, or that Volodymyr Valdemar of Rus in the 980s is Vladimir Putin of the Russian Federation in the 2010s, is to remove the centuries of interpretable material that permits historical thought and political judgment. It is also possible to see, in the 1,000 years since the baptism of Volodymyr Valdemar of Kiev, a history rather than a story of eternity. To think historically is not to trade one national myth for another. To say that Ukraine, rather than Russia, is the inheritor of Rus, that Volodymyr Valdemar was a Ukrainian and not a Russian. To make such a claim is merely to replace a Russian politics of eternity with a Ukrainian one. To think historically is to see how something like Ukraine might be possible, just as something like Russia might be possible. To think historically is to see the limits of structures, the spaces of indeterminacy, the possibilities for freedom. The configurations that make Ukraine possible today are visible in the medieval and early modern periods. The Rus of Volodymyr Valdemar was fractured long before the defeat of its warlords by the Mongols in the early 1240s. After the Mongol invasions, most of the territory of Rus was absorbed by the Grand Duchy of Lithuania in the 13th and 14th centuries. The Christian warlords of Rus then became leading figures of pagan Lithuania. The Grand Duchy of Lithuania adopted the political language of Rus for its laws and courts. From 1386, the Lithuanian Grand Dukes generally ruled Poland as well. The idea of a Ukraine to designate part of the lands of ancient Rus emerged after 1569, when the political relationship between Lithuania and Poland changed. In that year, the Kingdom of Poland and the Grand Duchy of Lithuania formed a commonwealth, a constitutional union of the two realms. During the bargaining, most of the territory of present-day Ukraine was shifted from the Lithuanian to the Polish part of the new common entity. This set off conflicts that created the political idea of Ukraine. After 1569, on the territory of today's Ukraine, the Eastern Christian traditions of Rus were challenged by Western Christianity, which was in the midst of fertile transformations. Polish Catholic and Protestant thinkers, aided by the printing press, challenged the hold of Eastern Christianity on the lands of Rus. Some of the Orthodox warlords of Rus converted to Protestantism or Catholicism and adopted the Polish language for communication among themselves. Following Polish models and the example of Polish nobles who moved east, these local magnates began to transform the fertile Ukrainian steppe into great plantations. This meant binding the local population to the land as serfs in order to exploit their labor. Ukrainian peasants who tried to flee serfdom often found another form of bondage, since they could be sold into slavery by neighboring Muslims in the extreme south of what is today Ukraine. These Muslims, known as Tatars, were under the suzerainty of the Ottoman Empire. Serfs found refuge with the Cossacks, free men who lived by raiding, hunting, and fishing at the southeastern edge of the steppe, in the no-man's land between Polish and Ottoman power. They built their fortress, or siege, on an island in the middle of the Dnipro River, not far from the present-day city that bears the river's name. In wartime, thousands of Cossacks fought as contract soldiers in the Polish army. When Cossacks fought as infantry and the Polish nobility as cavalry, the Polish army rarely lost. In the early 17th century, the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth was the largest state in Europe, and even briefly took Moscow. It was a republic of nobles, in which every nobleman was represented in parliament. In practice, of course, some noblemen were more powerful than others, and the wealthy magnates of Ukraine were among the most important citizens of the Commonwealth. Cossacks wanted to be ennobled, or at least to have fixed legal rights within the Commonwealth. This was not granted them. In 1648, these tensions brought rebellion. The Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth was about to undertake a campaign against the Ottoman Empire. The Cossacks who were preparing to take the field against the Ottomans instead found a leader, Bogdan Khmelnytsky, who persuaded them to rebel against local Polonized landlords. Knowing that he needed allies, Khmelnytsky recruited the Tatars, to whom he offered local Ukrainian Christians as slaves. When the Tatars deserted him, he needed a new ally, and Moscow was the only one he could find. There was nothing fated about this alliance. The Cossacks and the Muscovites both saw themselves as inheritors of Rus, but they had no common language and needed translators to communicate. Though a rebel, Khmelnytsky was a child of the Renaissance, Reformation, and Counter-Reformation, whose languages were Ukrainian, Polish, and Latin, but not Russian. The Cossacks were accustomed to legal contracts binding on both parties. They saw as a temporary arrangement what the Muscovite side regarded as a permanent subjugation to the Tsar. In 1654, Muscovy invaded the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. In 1667, the lands that are now Ukraine were split along the Dnipro River, with the Cossack strongholds falling to Muscovy. The status of Kiev was at first uncertain, but it too was ceded to Muscovy. Muscovy now turned westward after its long Asian career. The city of Kiev had existed for about 800 years without a political connection to Moscow. Kiev had passed through the Middle Ages, the Renaissance and the Baroque, the Reformation and the Counter-Reformation as a European metropolis. Once joined to Muscovy, its academy became the major institution of higher learning in the realm, which after 1721 was known as the Russian Empire. Kiev's educated men filled the professional classes of Moscow and then St. Petersburg. The Cossacks were assimilated into the Russian Imperial Armed Forces. Empress Catherine took a Cossack lover and deployed the Cossacks to conquer the Crimean Peninsula. At the end of the 18th century, the Russian Empire partitioned the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth out of existence with the help of Prussia and the Habsburg monarchy. In this way, almost all of the ancient lands of Rus became part of the new Russian Empire. In the 19th century, Russian imperial integration called forth a Ukrainian patriotic reaction. The Russian Imperial University in Kharkiv was the first center of a romantic tendency to idealize the local peasant and his culture. In mid-century Kiev, a few members of ancient noble families began to identify with the Ukrainian-speaking peasantry rather than with Russian or Polish power. At first, Russian rulers saw in these tendencies a laudable interest in South Russian or Little Russian culture. After Russia's defeat in the Crimean War of 1853-1856 and a Polish uprising of 1863-1864, Russian imperial authorities defined Ukrainian culture as a political danger and banned publications in the Ukrainian language. The statutes of the Grand Duchy of Lithuania, with their echoes of the ancient law of Rus, lost their force. The traditional place of Kiev as the center of Eastern Orthodoxy was assumed by Moscow. The Uniate Church, formed in 1596 with an Eastern liturgy but a Western hierarchy, was abolished. The one land of Rus that remained outside the Russian Empire was Galicia. When the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth had been partitioned out of existence at the end of the 18th century, Habsburg rulers ended up with these territories. As a Habsburg crownland, Galicia preserved certain features of Rus civilization, such as the Uniate Church. The Habsburg monarchy renamed it Greek Catholic and educated its priests in Vienna. Children and grandchildren of these men became Ukrainian national activists, editors of newspapers, and candidates to parliament. When the Russian Empire restricted Ukrainian culture, Ukrainian writers and activists moved to Galicia. After 1867, the Habsburg monarchy had a liberal constitution and a free press, so these political immigrants had the freedom to continue Ukrainian work. Austria held democratic elections, so party politics became national politics throughout the monarchy. Refugees from the Russian Empire defined Ukrainian politics and history as a matter of a continuous culture and language rather than imperial power. As for the peasants themselves, the vast bulk of the population that spoke the Ukrainian language was mainly concerned with owning land. After the Bolshevik Revolution of November 1917, a Ukrainian government declared independence. Yet unlike other East European peoples, Ukrainians were unable to form a state. No Ukrainian claim was recognized by the powers that won the First World War. Kyiv changed hands a dozen times among the Red Army, its white Russian opponents, a Ukrainian army, and the Polish army. Beleaguered Ukrainian authorities made an alliance with newly independent Poland, and together the Polish and Ukrainian armies took Kyiv in May 1920. When the Red Army counterattacked, Ukrainian soldiers fought alongside Poles all the way back to Warsaw. But when Poland and Bolshevik Russia signed their peace treaty at Riga in 1921, the lands that Ukrainian activists saw as theirs were divided. Almost all of what had been in the Russian Empire fell to the emerging Soviet Union, whereas Galicia and another western district, Volhynia, fell to Poland. This was not exceptional, but hypertypical. A Ukrainian nation-state lasted months, whereas its western neighbors lasted years, but the lesson was the same, and best learned from the Ukrainian example. The nation-state was difficult, and in most cases, untenable. Ukrainian history brings into focus a central question of modern European history. After empire, what? According to the fable of the wise nation, European nation-states learned a lesson from war and began to integrate. For this myth to make sense, nation-states must be imagined into periods when, in fact, they did not exist. The fundamental event of the middle of the European 20th century has to be removed. The attempts by Europeans to establish empires within Europe itself. The crucial case is the failed German attempt to colonize Ukraine in 1941. The rich black earth of Ukraine was at the center of the two major European neo-imperial projects of the 20th century, the Soviet and then the Nazi. In this respect as well, Ukrainian history is hypertypical and therefore indispensable. No other land attracted as much colonial attention within Europe. This reveals the rule. European history turns on colonization and decolonization. Joseph Stalin understood the Soviet project as self-colonization. Since the Soviet Union had no overseas possessions, it had to exploit its hinterlands. Ukraine was therefore to yield its agricultural bounty to Soviet central planners in the first five-year plan of 1928 to 1933. State control of agriculture killed between 3 and 4 million inhabitants of Soviet Ukraine by starvation. Adolf Hitler saw Ukraine as the fertile territory that would transform Germany into a world power. Control of its black earth was his war aim. As a result of the German occupation that began in 1941, more than 3 million more inhabitants of Soviet Ukraine were killed, including about 1.6 million Jews murdered by the Germans and local policemen and militias. In addition to those losses, some 3 million more inhabitants of Soviet Ukraine died in combat as Red Army soldiers. Taken together, some 10 million people were killed in a decade as a result of two rival colonizations of the same Ukrainian territory. After the Red Army defeated the Wehrmacht in 1945, the borders of Soviet Ukraine were extended westward to include districts taken from Poland as well as minor territories from Czechoslovakia and Romania. In 1954, the Crimean Peninsula was removed from the Russian-Soviet Federative Republic of the Soviet Union and added to Soviet Ukraine. This was the last of a series of border adjustments between the two Soviet republics. Since Crimea is connected to Ukraine by land, and an island from the perspective of Russia, the point was to connect the peninsula to the Ukrainian water supplies and electricity grids. The Soviet leadership took the opportunity to explain that Ukraine and Russia were unified by fate. Because the year 1954 was the 300th anniversary of the agreement that had united the Cossacks in Muscovy against the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth, Soviet factories produced cigarette packs and nightgowns with the logo 300 years. This was an early example of the Soviet politics of eternity, legitimating rule not by present achievement or future promise, but by the nostalgic loop of a round number. Soviet Ukraine was the second most populous republic of the USSR after Soviet Russia. In Soviet Ukraine's western districts, which had been part of Poland before the Second World War, Ukrainian nationalists resisted the imposition of Soviet rule. In a series of deportations in the late 1940s and early 1950s, they and their families were sent by the hundreds of thousands to the Soviet concentration camp system, the Gulag. In just a few days in October 1947, for example, 76,192 Ukrainians were transported to the Gulag in what was known as Operation West. Most of those who were still alive at the time of Stalin's death in 1953 were released by his successor, Nikita Khrushchev. In the 1960s and 1970s, Ukrainian communists joined their Russian comrades in governing the largest country in the world. During the Cold War, southeastern Ukraine was a Soviet military heartland. Rockets were built in Dnipropetrovsk, not far from where the Cossacks once had their fortress. Though Soviet policy had been lethal to Ukrainians, Soviet leaders never denied that Ukraine was a nation. The governing idea was that nations would achieve their full potential under Soviet rule and then dissolve once communism was achieved. In the early decades of the Soviet Union, the existence of a Ukrainian nation was taken for granted, from the journalism of Josef Rolt to the statistics of the League of Nations. The famine of 1932 to 1933 was also a war against the Ukrainian nation, in that it wrecked the social cohesion of villages and coincided with a bloody purge of Ukrainian national activists. Yet the vague idea remained that a Ukrainian nation would have a socialist future. It was really only in the 1970s, under Brezhnev, that Soviet policy officially dropped this pretense. In his myth of the Great Fatherland War, Russians and Ukrainians were merged as soldiers against fascism. When Brezhnev abandoned utopia for really existing socialism, he implied that the development of non-Russian nations was complete. Brezhnev urged that Russian become the language of communication for all Soviet elites, and a client of his ran Ukrainian affairs. Schools were Russified, and universities were to follow. In the 1970s, Ukrainian opponents of the Soviet regime risked prison and the psychiatric hospital to protest on behalf of Ukrainian culture. To be sure, Ukrainian communists joined wholeheartedly and in great numbers in the Soviet project, helping Russian communists to govern Asian regions of the USSR. After 1985, Gorbachev's attempt to bypass the Communist Party alienated such people, while his policy of glasnost, or open discussion, encouraged Soviet citizens to air national grievances. In 1986, his silence after the nuclear disaster at Chernobyl discredited him among many Ukrainians. Millions of inhabitants of Soviet Ukraine were needlessly exposed to high doses of radiation. It was hard to forgive his specific order that a May Day parade go forward under a deadly cloud. The senseless poisoning of 1986 prompted Ukrainians to begin to speak of the senseless mass starvation of 1933. In summer 1991, the failed coup against Gorbachev opened the way for Boris Yeltsin to lead Russia from the Soviet Union. Ukrainian communists and oppositionists alike agreed that Ukraine should follow suit. In a referendum, 92% of the inhabitants of Soviet Ukraine, including a majority in every Ukrainian region, voted for independence. As in the new Russia, the 1990s and the new Ukraine were marked by takeovers of Soviet assets and clever arbitrage schemes. Unlike in Russia, in Ukraine, the new class of oligarchs formed themselves into durable clans, none of which dominated the state for more than a few years at a time. And unlike in Russia, in Ukraine, power changed hands through democratic elections. Both Russia and Ukraine missed an opportunity for economic reform in the relatively good years before the world financial crisis of 2008. Unlike in Russia, in Ukraine, the European Union was seen as a cure for the corruption that hindered social advancement and a more equitable distribution of wealth. EU membership was consistently promoted, at least rhetorically, by Ukrainian leaders. The Ukrainian president from 2010, Viktor Yanukovych, promoted the idea of a European future, even as he pursued policies that made such a future less likely. Yanukovych's career demonstrates the difference between Ukrainian oligarchical pluralism and Russian kleptocratic centralism. He had run for president for the first time in 2004. The final count had been manipulated in his favor by his patron, the outgoing president Leonid Kuchma. Russian foreign policy was also to support his candidacy and declare his victory. After 3 weeks of protests on Kiev's independent square, known as the Maidan, a ruling of the Ukrainian Supreme Court, and new elections, Yanukovych accepted defeat. This was an important moment in Ukrainian history. It confirmed democracy as a succession principle. So long as the rule of law functioned at the heights of politics, there was always hope that it might one day extend to everyday life. After his defeat, Yanukovych hired the American political consultant Paul Manafort to improve his image. Although Manafort maintained a residence in Trump Tower in New York, he spent a great deal of time in Ukraine. Under Manafort's tutelage, Yanukovych got a better haircut and better suits and began to talk with his hands. Manafort helped him to pursue a southern strategy for Ukraine reminiscent of the one that his Republican Party had used in the United States, emphasizing cultural differences, making politics about being rather than doing. In the United States, this meant playing to the grievances of whites, even though they were a majority whose members held almost all the wealth. In Ukraine, it meant exaggerating the difficulties of people who spoke Russian, even though it was a major language of politics and economics of the country, and the first language of those who controlled the country's resources. Like Manafort's next client, Donald Trump, Yanukovych rose to power on a campaign of cultural grievance, mixed with the hope that an oligarch might defend the people against an oligarchy. After winning the presidential elections of 2010, Yanukovych concentrated on his own personal wealth. He seemed to be importing Russian practices by creating a permanent kleptocratic elite rather than allowing the rotation of oligarchical clans. His dentist son became one of the richest men in Ukraine. Yanukovych undermined the checks and balances among the branches of the Ukrainian government, for example, by making the judge who had misplaced his criminal record the chief justice of the Ukrainian Supreme Court. Yanukovych also tried to manage democracy in the Russian style. He put one of his two major opponents in prison and had a law passed that disqualified the other from running for president. This left him running for a second term against a handpicked nationalist opponent. Yanukovych was certain to win, after which he could tell Europeans and Americans that he had saved Ukraine from nationalism. As a new state, Ukraine had enormous problems, most obviously corruption. An association agreement with the EU, which Yanukovych promised to sign, would be an instrument to support the rule of law within Ukraine. The historical function of the EU was precisely the rescue of the European state after empire. Yanukovych might not have understood this, but many Ukrainian citizens did. For them, only the prospect of an association agreement made his regime tolerable. So when Yanukovych suddenly declared on November 21, 2013, that Ukraine would not sign the association agreement, he became intolerable. Yanukovych had made his decision after speaking with Putin. The Russian politics of eternity, ignored by most Ukrainians until then, was suddenly at the doorstep. It is the investigative journalists who bring oligarchy and inequality into view. As chroniclers of the contemporary, they react first to the politics of eternity. In the oligarchical Ukraine of the 21st century, reporters gave their fellow citizens a chance at self-defense. Mustafa Nayim was one of these investigative journalists, and on November 21st, he had had enough. Writing on his Facebook page, Nayim urged his friends to go out to protest. "Likes don't count," he wrote. People would have to take their bodies to the streets. And so they did. In the beginning, students and young people, thousands of them from Kiev and around the country, the citizens with the most to lose from a frozen future. They came to the Maidan and they stayed. And in so doing, they took part in the creation of a new thing, a nation. Whatever the flaws of the Ukrainian political system, Ukrainians after 1991 had come to take for granted that political disputes would be settled without violence. Exceptions, such as the murder of the popular investigative reporter Georgi Gongadze in 2000, brought protests. In a country that had seen more violence in the 20th century than any other, the civic peace of the 21st was a proud achievement. Alongside the regularity of elections and the absence of war, the right to peaceful assembly was one way that Ukrainians themselves distinguished their country from Russia. So it came as a shock when riot police attacked the protesters on the Maidan on November 30th. News that our children had been beaten spread through Kiev. The spilling of the first drop of blood stirred people to action. Ukrainian citizens came to Kiev to help the students because they were troubled by violence. One of them was Sergei Nihoyan, a Russian-speaking ethnic Armenian from the southeastern district of Ukraine known as the Donbas. A worker himself, he expressed solidarity with students, citizens of Ukraine. The reflex of protecting the future, triggered in the minds of students by the fear of losing Europe, was triggered in others by the fear of losing the one generation raised in an independent Ukraine. Among the representatives of older generations who came to the Maidan to protect the students were the Afghans, veterans of the Red Army's invasion of Afghanistan. The protests of December 2013 were less about Europe and more about the proper form of politics in Ukraine, about decency or dignity. On December 10, 2013, the riot police were sent in a second time to clear the Maidan of protesters. Once again, the word went out, and Kievans of all walks of life decided to put their bodies in front of batons. A young businesswoman recalled that her friends were shaving and putting on clean clothes in case they should die that night. A middle-aged literary historian ventured forth with an elderly couple, a publisher and a physician. My friends were an invalid who was well over 60, and his wife of about the same age. Next to them I seemed rather young, strong and healthy. I'm a 53-year-old woman. And of course, at my age, it is difficult to think of physically overcoming armed men. My friends are both Jews, and I am a Polish citizen, but we walk together, as Ukrainian patriots, convinced that our lives would be of no value if the protests were crushed now. We made it to the Maidan, not without some difficulties. My friend Lena, a doctor, the gentlest being in the world, is only a meter and a half tall. I had to keep her at a distance from the riot police, because I knew that she would tell them exactly what she thought of them and the whole situation. On December 10th, the riot police could not move the crowd. On January 16th, 2014, Yanukovych retroactively criminalized the protests and legalized his own use of force. The official parliamentary record included a raft of legislation which the protesters called dictatorship laws. These measures severely limited freedom of expression and freedom of assembly, banning undefined extremism, and requiring non-governmental organizations that receive money from abroad to register as foreign agents. The laws were introduced by deputies with ties to Russia and were copies of Russian legislation. There were no public hearings, no parliamentary debate, and indeed no actual vote. A show of hands was improperly used instead of an electronic count, and the number of hands raised was short of a majority. The laws were nevertheless entered into the books. Protesters recognized that they would be treated as criminals if apprehended. 6 days later, two protesters were shot dead. From the perspective, say, of either the United States or Russia, both much more violent societies, it is hard to appreciate the weight of these two deaths for Ukrainians. The mass killings by sniper fire 4 weeks later would overshadow these first two deaths. The Russian invasion of Ukraine that began 5 weeks later brought so much more bloodshed that it can seem impossible to recall how the killing began. And yet, to the society actually concerned, there were specific moments that seemed intolerable breaches of common decency. In the final week of January, Ukrainian citizens who had not previously supported the Maidan protests began to arrive in large numbers from all over the country. Because it seemed that Yanukovych had now bloodied his hands, his further rule was inconceivable to many Ukrainians. Protesters experienced this moment as the warping of their own political society. A demonstration that had begun in defense of a European future had become a defense of the few tenuous gains in the Ukrainian present. By February, the Maidan was a desperate stand against Eurasia. Until then, few Ukrainians had given any thought to the Russian politics of eternity. But protesters did not want what they saw on offer: violence leading to a futureless life amid wisps of what might have been. As February began, Yanukovych was still the president, and Washington and Moscow had ideas about how he might remain in power. A telephone call between an American assistant secretary of state and the American ambassador in Kiev, apparently recorded by a Russian secret service and leaked on February 4th, revealed that American policy was to support the formation of a new government under Yanukovych. This proposal was out of line with the demands of the Maidan and, indeed, completely out of touch. Yanukovych's rule was already over, at least in the minds of those who chose to risk their lives on the Maidan after the killings of January 22, 2014. A survey showed that only 1% of protesters would accept a political compromise that left Yanukovych in office. On February 18th, parliamentary discussions began, with the hope that some compromise could be found. Instead, the next day saw a bloody confrontation that made the continuation of Yanukovych's regime even less likely. The history of the Maidan between November 2013 and February 2014 the work of more than a million people presenting their bodies to the cold stone, is not the same thing as the history of the failed attempts to put it down. Bloodshed had been unthinkable for protesters within Ukraine. Only bloodshed made Americans and Europeans notice the country. Bloodshed served Moscow as an argument to send the Russian army to bring much more. And so the temptation is strong to recall Ukraine as it was seen from the outside, the arc of narrative following the arc of bullets. For those who took part in the Maidan, their protest was about defending what was still thought to be possible, a decent future for their own country. The violence mattered to them as a marker of the intolerable. It came in bursts of a few moments or a few hours. But people came to the Maidan not for moments or hours, but for days, weeks, and months, their own fortitude suggesting a new sense of time and new forms of politics. Those who remained on the Maidan could do so only because they found new ways to organize themselves. The Maidan brought four forms of politics: the civil society, the economy of gift, the voluntary welfare state, and the Maidan friendship. Kyiv is a bilingual capital, something unusual in Europe and unthinkable in Russia and the United States. Europeans, Russians, and Americans rarely considered that everyday bilingualism might bespeak political maturity, and imagined instead that a Ukraine that spoke two languages must be divided into two groups and two halves. Ethnic Ukrainians must be a group that acts in one way, and ethnic Russians in another. This is about as true as to say that ethnic Americans vote Republican. It is more of a summary of a politics that defines people by ethnicity, proposing to them an eternity of grievance rather than a politics of the future. And Ukraine, language is a spectrum rather than a line. Or, if it is a line, it is one that runs inside of people rather than between them. Ukrainian citizens on the Maidan spoke as they did in everyday life, using Ukrainian and Russian as it suited them. The revolution was begun by a journalist who used Russian to tell people where to put the camera, and Ukrainian when he spoke in front of it. His famous Facebook post, "Likes Don't Count," was in Russian. On the Maidan, the question of who spoke what language was irrelevant. As the protester Ivan Sorenko remembered, writing in Russian, "The Maidan crowd is tolerant on the language question. I never heard any discussions about the matter." In one survey, 59% of the people on the Maidan defined themselves as Ukrainian speakers, 16% as Russian speakers, and 25% as both. People switched languages as the situation seemed to demand. People spoke Ukrainian from the stage erected at the Maidan, since Ukrainian is the language of politics. But then the speaker might return to the crowd and speak to friends in Russian. This was the everyday behavior of a new political nation. The politics of this nation were about the rule of law. First, the hope that an association agreement with the European Union could reduce corruption. Then the determination to prevent the rule of law from disappearing entirely under the waves of state violence. In surveys, protesters most often selected the defense of the rule of law as their major goal. The political theory was simple. The state needed civil society to lead it toward Europe, and the state needed Europe to lead it away from corruption. Once the violence began, this political theory expressed itself in more poetic forms. The philosopher Volodymyr Yarmolenko wrote, "Europe is also a light at the end of a tunnel. When do you need a light like that? When it is pitch dark all around." In the meantime, civil society had to work in darkness. Ukrainians did so by forming horizontal networks with no relationship to political parties. As the protester Ihor Bihun recalled, there was no fixed membership, there was no hierarchy either. The political and social activity of the Maidan from December 2013 through February 2014 arose from temporary associations based upon will and skill. The essential idea was that freedom was responsibility. There was thus pedagogy, libraries and schools, security, samoobrona or self-defense, external affairs, the Council of Maidan, aid for victims of violence and people seeking missing loved ones, Euromaidan SOS, and anti-propaganda, InfoResist. As the protester Andriy Bondar remembered, self-organization was a challenge to the dysfunctional Ukrainian state. On the Maidan, a Ukrainian civil society of incredible self-organization and solidarity is thriving. On the one hand, this society is internally differentiated by ideology, language, culture, religion, and class. But on the other hand, it is united by certain elementary sentiments. We do not need your permission. We are not going to ask you for something. We are not afraid of you. We will do everything ourselves. The economy of the Maidan was one of gift. In its first few days, as Natalia Stelmach recalled, the people of Kiev gave with extraordinary generosity. Within 2 days, other volunteers and I were able to collect in hryvnia the equivalent of about $40,000 in cash from simple residents of Kiev. She remembered trying and failing to prevent an elderly pensioner from donating half of a monthly check. Aside from donations in cash, people provided food, clothes, wood, medications, barbed wire, and helmets. A visitor would be surprised to find deep order amidst apparent chaos and realize that what seemed at first like extraordinary hospitality was in fact a spontaneous welfare state. The Polish political activist Sławomir Siedzikowski was duly impressed. You walk through the Maidan and you are presented with food, clothing, a place to sleep, and medical care. In early 2014, the vast majority of the protesters, some 88% of the hundreds of thousands of people who appeared, were from beyond Kiev. Only 3% came as representatives of political parties, and only 13% as members of non-governmental organizations. According to surveys taken at the time, almost all of the protesters, about 86%, made up their own minds to come, and came as individuals or families or groups of friends. They were taking part in what the art curator Vasil Chedepanin called corporeal politics, getting their faces away from screens and their bodies among other bodies. Patient protest amidst increasing risks generated the idea of the Maidan friend, the person you trusted because of common trials. The historian Yaroslav Fritsak described one way that new acquaintances were made. On the Maidan, you were a pixel, and pixels always work in groups. Groups were mostly formed spontaneously. You or your friend bumped into somebody you or your friend know, and the person whom you met did not walk alone. He or she would be also accompanied by his or her friends, unless you start to walk together. One night, I walked with an unlikely group of soldiers of fortune, my friend the philosopher and a businessman whom I know. He was accompanied by a tiny man with sad eyes. He looked like a sad clown, and I found out that he was indeed a professional clown who organized a charitable group that worked with children who had cancer. Having come as individuals, Ukrainian citizens on the Maidan joined new institutions. In practicing corporeal politics, they were placing their bodies at risk. As the philosopher Yarmolenko put it, we are dealing with revolutions in which people make a gift of themselves. People often express this as a kind of personal transformation, a choice unlike other choices. Hryzak and others recalled the French philosopher Albert Camus and his idea of a revolt as the moment when death is chosen over submission. Posters on the Maidan quoted the 1755 letter by the American founding father Benjamin Franklin. Those who would give up essential liberty to purchase a little temporary safety deserve neither liberty nor safety. A group of Ukrainian lawyers waited on the Maidan day after day, holding a sign reading, Lawyers of the Maidan. People who had been beaten or otherwise abused by the state could report the wrongdoing and begin a legal case. Lawyers and others on the Maidan were not thinking of the enduring problem of Russian political philosophy, how to generate a spirit of law in an autocratic system. And yet, by their actions on behalf of a vision of law, they were addressing the very problem that had haunted Ilin. 100 years before, in the waning years of the Russian Empire, Ilin had wished for a Russia ruled by law, but could not see how its spirit would ever reach the people. After the Bolshevik Revolution, he accepted that lawlessness from the far left must be met by lawlessness from the far right. At the very moment that Putin was applying Ilin's notion of law to Russia, Ukrainians were demonstrating that the authoritarian shortcut could be resisted. Ukrainians demonstrated their attachment to law by cooperating with others and by risking themselves. If Ukrainians could solve Ilin's riddle of law by invoking Europe in solidarity, surely Russians could too? That was a thought that Russian leaders could not permit their citizens to entertain. And so, 2 years after the protests in Moscow, Russian leaders applied the same tactics to Kyiv. The homosexualization of protest to evoke a sense of eternal civilization, and then the application of violence to make change seem impossible. In late 2011, when Russians protested faked elections, their leaders associated the protesters with homosexuality. In late 2013, confronted with a Maidan in Ukraine, the men of the Kremlin made the same move. After 2 years of anti-gay propaganda in the Russian Federation, the ideologues and entertainers were sure of themselves. Their starting point was that the European Union was homosexual, and so the Ukrainian movement towards Europe must be as well. The Izvor's Club claimed that the EU groans under the weight of the LGBT lobby's domination. In November and December 2013, the Russian media covering the Maidan introduced the irrelevant theme of gay sex at every turn. When covering the very first day of protests by Ukrainian students in favor of the association agreement, the Russian media sought to fascinate its readers by conflating Ukrainian politics with handsome men and gay sex. A social media page of Vitaly Klitschko, a heavyweight boxer who led a Ukrainian political party, was hacked and gay material introduced. Then this was presented as a news story for millions of Russians on a major television station, NTV. Before Russians could apprehend that pro-European protests were underway in the neighboring country, they were invited to contemplate taboo sex. Right after students began their protests on the Maidan, the Russian television channel NTV warned of homo dictatorship in Ukraine. Viktor Shostakov, writing for Odna Rodina, claimed that a specter is haunting the Maidan, the specter of homosexuality. The fact that the first and the most zealous integrators in Ukraine are local sexual perverts has long been known. Dmitry Kiselov, the leading figure in Russian television media, warmed to the theme. In December 2013, he was appointed the director of a new media conglomerate known as Rossiya Segodnya, or Russia Today. Its aim was to dissolve the Russian state media's pursuit of news as such into a new pursuit of useful fiction. He greeted his new staff with the words, "Objectivity is a myth," and set the new editorial line as, "Love for Russia." On December 1, 2013, the World Press reported the beating of students by Ukrainian riot police the previous night. As Ukrainian students huddled in a church tending their wounds, Kiselov found a way to formulate their protests as sexual geopolitics. That evening, on Vesti Nedeli, recalling to his viewers the Great Northern War of the early 18th century, he described the European Union as a new alliance turned against Russia. This time, however, Kiselov claimed, the Swedish, Polish, and Lithuanian enemies were warriors of sexual perversion. Poland and Lithuania were not, in fact, enemies of Russia in the Great Northern War. Getting one's own history wrong is essential to eternity politics. In another episode, Kiselov expressed his delight to have discovered a magazine with a nude photo shoot of Klitschko from a decade earlier. On the set, Kiselov stroked the black riot gear worn by the Ukrainian police as the camera zoomed in. Meanwhile, the newspaper Segodnya breathlessly praised itself for publishing a photograph that framed Klitschko together with a gay Ukrainian writer. In the Ukrainian context, these were two activists at a press conference. In the Russian press, the sexual orientation of the one and the male beauty of the other was the story. European integration was interpreted by Russian politicians to mean a legalization of same-sex partnerships, which was not an element of Ukraine's association agreement with the EU, and thus the spread of homosexuality. When the German foreign minister visited Kyiv on December 4th, the newspaper Komsomolskaya Pravda headlined the meeting as "Gay Firewood on the Maidan Fire." While the Putin regime had crushed protests at home in 2011-2012, it sought to redefine politics as innocence rather than action. Rather than asking how past experience might instruct reformers of the present about possibilities for the future, Russians were meant to adapt their minds to a news cycle which instructed them on their own innocence. One eternal verity of Russian civilization turned out to be sexual anxiety. If Russia were indeed a virginal organism threatened by the world's uncomprehending malice, as Eileen had suggested, then Russian violence was a righteous defense against penetration. For Putin, as for Eileen, Ukraine was part of that national body. For Eurasia to come into being, Ukrainian domestic politics would have to become more like Russian domestic politics. When Yanukovych announced that he would not sign the EU association agreement in November 2013, this was celebrated by the Russian government as a victory. But Yanukovych had not actually agreed to join Eurasia, a move that would have been even more unpopular among Ukrainians. In December 2013 and January 2014, the Kremlin tried to help Yanukovych crush protest and thereby make it possible for him to complete his turn from the EU towards Eurasia. Yanukovych claimed that both Europe and Russia wanted Ukraine, and each needed to pay him off. While the EU refused, Putin was ready to offer Yanukovych money. On December 17, 2013, Putin offered Yanukovych a package of $15 billion in bond purchases and reduced prices for natural gas. The aid seemed to be conditional. It was offered along with Russian requests that the streets of Kyiv be cleared of protesters. By then, the Ukrainian riot police had already failed twice in this mission, on November 30th and December 10th. They had also been abducting individual protesters thought to be leaders and beating them. None of this was working, so Russians came to help. A group of 27 Russian specialists in the suppression of protests, officers of the FSB, and instructors from the Ministry of Internal Affairs arrived in Kyiv. On January 9, 2014, the Russian ambassador to Ukraine informed Yanukovych that Ukrainian riot policemen would be given Russian citizenship after the coming operation to crush the Maidan. This was a very important assurance, since it meant that these policemen did not need to fear the consequences of their actions. If the opposition won in the end, they would still be safe. Moscow apparently calculated in January 2014 that a more competent application of violence would break the protests and transform Yanukovych into a puppet. It did not enter into Russian calculations that Ukrainian citizens were on the Maidan for patriotic reasons of their own. When the Yanukovych regime introduced the Russian-style dictatorship laws of January 16, 2014, this suggested massive violence to come. Russian-style laws did not have the same consequences in Ukraine as in Russia. Ukrainian protesters saw them as offensive foreign implants. When those two protesters were killed on January 22nd, the Maidan grew as never before. Remote control counter-revolution had failed. Moscow was unable to move Ukraine into Eurasia by helping Yanukovych to repress the opposition. It was time for a shift in strategy. By early February 2014, it appeared Moscow no longer aimed to maneuver Yanukovych and Ukraine into Eurasia. Instead, Yanukovych would be sacrificed in a campaign to provoke chaos throughout the country. A major actor in the new policy was Igor Girkin, a colonel in Russian military intelligence, GRU, who was employed by Konstantin Malofeyev. Known in Russia as the Orthodox Oligarch, Malofeyev was an anti-sodomy activist and an outspoken Russian imperialist. In his view, Ukraine is part of Russia. I can't consider the Ukrainian people as non-Russian. Ukraine had to be saved by Russia from Europe because otherwise Ukrainian citizens would have had to spread sodomy as a norm in traditional Ukrainian society. This was not true in any factual sense. Malofeyev was expressing the orientation of Russian policy, to present Europe as a civilizational enemy, homosexuality as the war, and Ukraine as the battleground. Malofeyev's employee Girkin was experienced in irregular warfare. He had fought as a Russian volunteer on the Serbian side in the Yugoslav wars, taking part in engagements in Bosnian towns and UN-declared safe areas where ethnic cleansing and mass rape took place. He had also fought in Russia's wars in Transnistria and Chechnya, and had written about these experiences for media edited by the fascist Alexander Prokhanov. Girkin spent the days between January 22nd and February 4th, 2014 in Kyiv, and then, it seems, recommended to the Kremlin that Ukraine be invaded and dismembered. A memorandum that circulated in the Russian presidential administration in early February 2014, apparently based on the work of Girkin, anticipated the change in the course of Russian policy. It began from the premise that the Yanukovych regime is utterly bankrupt. Its diplomatic, financial, and propaganda support by the Russian state no longer makes any sense. Russian interests in Ukraine were defined as the military-industrial complex of Ukraine southeast and control over the gas transport system in the entire country. Russia's main goal should be the disintegration of the Ukrainian state. The proposed tactic was to discredit both Yanukovych and the opposition by violence while invading southern Ukraine and destabilizing the Ukrainian state. The memorandum included three propaganda strategies meant to provide cover for such a Russian intervention. One, to demand that Ukraine federalize itself in the interests of a supposedly oppressed Russian minority. Two, to define opponents of the Russian invasion as fascists. And three, to characterize the invasion as a civil war stoked by the West. In a policy paper of February 13, 2014, the Izborsk Club repeated the contents of the confidential Kremlin memorandum. The Maidan might inspire Russians to act and was therefore intolerable. Yanukovych was finished. Therefore, Russia should invade Ukraine and take what it could. As with the presidential memorandum, the guiding concept of the Izborsk policy paper was that Russia should seize some Ukrainian territory and then wait for the state to collapse. The Izborsk Club also proposed that Russian television channels justify the intervention in Ukraine by the deliberate, premeditated fiction that a fascist coup is coming. This would indeed be a major line of Russian propaganda once war began. On the day that the Izborsk Club was propagating this general idea, Vladislav Surkov, Putin's propaganda genius, arrived in the South Ukrainian province of Crimea. The next day, Surkov flew from Crimea to Kiev. Foreign Minister Lavrov chose that very day, February 14, 2014, to formalize the idea that Russian civilization was an innocent body defending itself from Western perversion. In the newspaper Kommersant, Lavrov repeated Ilin's idea that society is a living organism that had to be protected from Europe's hedonistic refusal of traditional values. Lavrov presented the Ukrainians who were struggling, and by that point dying, for European ideas of law as the prey of European sexual politics. Even as Russian troops were mobilizing to invade Ukraine and overturn its government, Lavrov presented Russia as the victim. The true aggressors, according to Lavrov, were the international gay lobbyists who propagated with missionary insistence both inside their own countries and in relations with neighbors. Surkov left Kiev on February 15th. Live ammunition was distributed to the Ukrainian riot police on February 16th. On February 18th, Ukrainians waited while parliamentary deputies discussed a constitutional compromise. Instead, protesters on the Maidan were surprised by massive and lethal violence. Now, European actors finally began to move. Although the protests had been pro-European from the beginning, they had not been meaningfully supported by the European Union, its member states, or any Western actor. European public opinion took little notice of the Maidan before the violence began. Politicians issued bland and interchangeable calls for both sides to avoid violence. Once the violence began, diplomats expressed official concern. Diplomatic discourse became a cause for mockery on the Maidan, as people who risked their lives found themselves alone and isolated. As violence increased, the mockery turned to pathos. Ukrainian protesters on the Maidan flew flags of an imagined United States of Russia to express their view that the great powers shared a common indifference or hostility. The most significant initiative came from a European diplomat. Polish Foreign Minister Radosław Sikorski persuaded his French and German colleagues to join him in Kiev for talks with Yanukovych on February 20th. A Russian diplomat joined the group. Over the course of a long and difficult day of negotiations, Yanukovych agreed to leave office at the end of 2014, before his term was over. As impressive as this diplomatic resolution might have seemed, it was outdated before it was signed. Russian authorities had already concluded that Yanukovych was doomed, and the Russian invasion force was already on the move. Signing the agreement allowed Russia to blame others for failing to fulfill its terms, even as the Russian invasion that followed 4 days later drastically changed the conditions under which it had been signed. The moment had passed when Ukrainian protesters might have accepted Yanukovych as president. Had there been any doubt that he had to resign on the morning of February 20th, it had dissipated by the end of the day. On February 20th, there was another Russian delegation in Kiev, led by Vladislav Surkov and including Sergei Beseda, a general of the FSB. These Russians were not there to negotiate. As others did so, snipers hidden near the Maidan shot and killed about 100 people, most of them protesters, a few of them Ukrainian riot policemen. It was unclear what, if any, part of the Ukrainian government was involved in these shootings. After the mass killing, Yanukovych was abandoned by the parliamentary deputies who had supported him and the policemen who had protected him. He fled his garish residence, leaving behind a trove of documents, including records of large cash payments to his advisor Paul Manafort, who 2 years later surfaced as the campaign manager of Donald Trump. The sniper massacre and the flight of Yanukovych marked the shift from Russia's first Eurasian plan to its second. Russian leaders had accepted that Yanukovych was useless. His bloody downfall, foreseen in Moscow, created the chaos that served as cover for the second strategy, military intervention designed to make the state as a whole disintegrate. In the few days between the sniper massacre of February 20th and the Russian invasion of Ukraine on February 24th, shocking but fictitious reports appeared about Ukrainian atrocities in Crimea and about refugees from the peninsula who needed urgent assistance. Russian military intelligence created fictitious personae on the internet to spread these stories. A group of internet trolls in St. Petersburg, known as the Internet Research Agency, was at work to confuse Ukrainian and international opinion. This was by now a signature of Russian foreign policy, the cyber campaign that would accompany a real war. By the time Yanukovych surfaced in Russia, the Russian invasion of Ukraine was underway. It began from Crimea, the southern peninsula of Ukraine, where by treaty Russia had naval bases. Some 2,000 naval infantry were permanently stationed in Sevastopol alone. These troops had been reinforced since the previous December by soldiers arriving from the Russian Federation. Russian Army units 27777, 73612, 74268, and 54607 were among the 22,000 troops brought from Russia. Girkin had visited Crimea in January. In February, he was accompanied by his friend Alexander Borodai, a Eurasianist, an admirer of Gumilov, a writer for Prokhanov's media, and the head of public relations for Malofeyev. Beginning on February 24, 2014, some 10,000 Russian special forces, in uniform but without insignia, moved northward through the Crimean Peninsula. The moment they left their bases, they were engaged in an illegal invasion of Ukraine. Kiev was caught by surprise at a moment when chains of command were uncertain, and the main concern was to avoid further violence. Provisional Ukrainian authorities ordered Ukrainian forces on the peninsula not to resist. By the night of February 26th, Russian soldiers had seized the regional parliament building in the city of Simferopol and raised the Russian flag. According to Girkin, he was in command of the concurrent operation to seize the Simferopol airport. On February 27th, Putin's Eurasia advisor Sergei Glazyov placed a telephone call to Crimea to arrange the new government. A local Russian gangster named Sergei Aksionov was proclaimed Prime Minister of Crimea. Borodai was his media advisor. On February 28th, the Russian parliament endorsed the incorporation of Ukrainian territory into the Russian Federation. On that day, the President of the United States said that he was deeply concerned by reports of military movements taken by the Russian Federation inside of Ukraine. This was Barack Obama's first public statement about the crisis. The public spectacle of the Russian invasion was provided by the Night Wolves, a Russian biker gang that served as a paramilitary and propaganda arm of the Putin regime. On February 28th, the day that the Russian parliament voted for annexation, the Night Wolves were dispatched to Crimea. The bikers had been organizing rallies in Crimea for years, accompanied personally by Putin in 2012. Putin could not ride a motorcycle, so he was given a trike. Now the Night Wolves provided the face that Russia chose to show of itself. A few months earlier, one of the Night Wolves had described their worldview, You have to learn to see the holy war underneath the everyday. Democracy is a fallen state. To split left and right is to divide. In the kingdom of God, there is only above and below. All is one, which is why the Russian soul is holy. It can unite everything, liken an icon, Stalin and God.